This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Suits and limousines, all important people, meet in locked off rooms. From outside our voices, calling save the climate. From the streets of Paris, oh yeah. Oh yeah, that was me singing Rebellious Hope for the Paris Climate Talks of 2015. Now, as the bitter winter of 2018 ends, or summer if you're in Australia, there are riots in the streets of Paris against the carbon tax, against climate action. The same suits and limousines have flown this time to Katowice, Poland, in the 24th mega meeting of the world governments for more talk about climate action. World greenhouse gas emissions have never been higher. Climate-driven weather violence is already raging. There will be no answer from COP24. Again, we bring reports recorded live from the NGO Press Center at the Poland Talks. The group Scientists Warning convenes a panel that includes one of our favorite climate truth tellers, the UK's Dr. Kevin Anderson. Kevin explains where real action could start and the myths world governments are selling us. Then host Stuart Scott goes one-on-one with another inconvenient critic of these international climate shows, Britain's ice super scientist Peter Wadhams. You want to know what is happening at the latest conference talks? I will have more comments at the end of this show, but let's get to the awful truth direct from Katowice, Poland.
Radio EcoShock.
I do think we need to sort of almost stop and reflect that we are 28 years now on since the first report from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. The emissions are probably at 65% higher and are still going up. And we still meet in these events like this and we still say the same things we've been saying for pretty much 28 years.
I want to thank you all for coming to the another Scientists Warning TV program here from COP24 in Katowice, Poland. The hosts today, Victoria Hirth, who's an associate professor of sustainable business at the University of Plymouth, and my name's Stuart Scott. I'm the executive director of ScientistsWarning.org and a member of Survival University. And our guests today, very pleased to have with us, Professor Kevin Anderson, who's deputy director of the Tyndall Center for Climate Change Research. And he is associated with the faculties of the universities of Manchester and Uppsala in Sweden. And with him, Dr. Hugh Hunt at the Department of Engineering at Cambridge University. Today's program, a rule book for the climate casino.
We've got this thought experiment here, which you can see on the screen. Now, the question is really quite important. If you imagine that we actually thought climate change was a real existential threat, a real serious issue. And so we put in regulations at a global level so that the top 10% of global emitters had to reduce their carbon footprint to the level of the average European person. So just the top 10% of high emitters down to the level of the average European. And the other 90% of the world's population made no reduction in their current level of emissions.
Okay, so when you say the top 10%, are we in that top 10%?
We probably are. We're probably definitely in the top 20%. We may well be in the top 10, depending exactly what we do. But yes, people like us.
So the top 10%, we're talking about people who have high consumption lifestyles. They fly a lot. They travel a lot. They have perhaps more than two homes. More than one home.
Yeah, but certainly more than one home, yes.
And they're...
Well, I was just going to say, the figures about 10 years ago, that if you had about £53,000 worth of assets, you were in the top 10%.
Okay.
As a ballpark.
Yeah.
So the question then is, if these people were to reduce their emissions to the European average...
Yeah, the European average, yeah.
And the European average is... Well, people don't travel a lot outside of Europe. Europeans are... fairly frugal about travelling.
Something like that, yeah. I think probably still people travel quite a lot within Europe. But there are probably a lot of people who don't make intercontinental flights.
But these people have got very comfortable lifestyles.
Yeah, a lot of the people in Europe. I think the average person in Europe is a reasonable, comfortable person.
And so what you're saying is the figure that you've got on that slide is that if that happened, then that's one-third off global emissions.
Yeah, one-third. And I think what's important there is that if you look at the Paris Agreement, all the pledges that were made by all the countries around the world, that's for virtually no reduction by 2030. So what I'm simply saying here is this isn't going to solve climate change. But if we thought it was a really serious issue, just 10% reducing to the level of the average European is a one-third cut in global emissions. Now, as I say, we have to do a lot more than that, but that would be a very good start.
Don't you think that just doing away with the COP would reduce like 10% of our global emissions?
Well, it might have some impact. In fact, we're going to touch on that next, I think.
Yeah. Well, so the idea that we kind of know who these high emitters are, they're wealthy people? What do you mean by... No?
Well, we wouldn't call them wealthy because they're our friends and our family, probably. I mean, we often find that there's people we hang around with, the people in COP typically, the people that we spend our time with, our friends, our family, the communities we work within, that most of those people are probably relatively wealthy. So, but it's not just about them. It's the point about this cartoon you can see here is that the whole mindset that has driven, for at least the last 30 or 40 years, how virtually all governments now think about these issues, this sort of Davos mentality. You can call it the socioeconomic model or the neoliberal model, but basically it's one of ongoing growth with very high levels of inequality at a global level, but even within countries, very high levels of inequality. That's the norm that we've got now that we daren't question. So almost that's a given.
It's a given because we've got our pensions are hooked up in economic growth, the future. We just assume that the things that we own now will be more valuable in 10 years' time. I mean, it's kind of the norm. But how does that link into climate change?
Well, it's very clear links between economic growth and our carbon emissions. So if you look at this next slide, what that's hinting at is that we've gone from this sort of Davos world where you've got these incredibly wealthy people turning up once a year at Davos and discussing world problems like hunger and poverty with no understanding of the irony of that, really, that these are the people that in many respects are causing the problems because of their completely profligate level of consumption, and that they've set a model that the rest of us are all aspiring to. We'll probably never get there, but we're all aspiring to that. And what I would argue is that hasn't the COP and the way we're dealing with climate change sort of become part of that? That what we have is this, if you like, the climate, I call them climate glitterati, that claim to be concerned about climate change, and it can always be solved by some technology in the future. So there's no problem with them and how they live their lives, but they like that idea of rubbing shoulders with the people from Davos. There's this whole sort of prestige that is passed down from this group of elites across the climate, this climate glitterati group, and that, if you like, cascades down through the whole system. So we're all now developing solutions that don't question the current economic model. We can't question that.
So the recent IPCC 1.5 degree report, which came out, 6 weeks ago or thereabouts, is full of lots of technologies, negative emissions technologies, BECCS, bioenergy with carbon capture and storage, that the models seem to be that we're not going to change our habits much, so we're going to need technologies to achieve the Paris Agreement. Now, the problem surely with these technologies is that they don't exist yet. The climate casino is we're gambling on there being technical solutions to do these negative emissions. And if not, then what happens?
Well, there's two gambles. We're gambling, firstly, that they will work, and they will work at huge planetary scale. And just give some feeling of that, you're talking about hundreds of billions, even up to maybe a trillion tons of carbon dioxide sucked out of the atmosphere by these technologies that we do not have at the moment. But on top of that, because we know they're going to happen later in the century when people like you and I are retired. And that we hope that in the interim, that the feedbacks in the climate system will not make the situation much worse. So rather than reduce our emissions today very significantly, we're going to gamble that feedbacks aren't going to be very great and that we're then going to have these technologies in years to come.
Well, so you were saying earlier that if the top 10% of emitters were to reduce their emissions to the average EU European level...
Yeah. Not voluntarily, I don't think.
Well, yeah, okay, we'll have to give them a little bit of a nudge. But that would be one-third of our emissions. And so that's about 10 billion tonnes of CO2 every year. That's what
That's a bit more than that, but yes, yeah.
So thereabouts. So that's in 10 years, that's 100 billion tonnes. I mean, that's a trillion tonnes for the century, in a century.
I mean, yes.
So we can solve the problem.
Before you go on, you were talking about negative emissions technologies. Yeah. They exist or they don't yet exist?
Well, they do. But are not on a scale that we need them on. For example, one negative emissions technology is to plant lots of trees, which sucks CO2 out of the atmosphere, burn those trees in our power stations instead of burning coal, and then capture the CO2 from the chimneys and put that CO2 underground. So that's bioenergy with carbon capture and storage. Well, that's a negative emissions technology because the CO2 is coming in into your biomass, into your trees, and then it's ending up underground.
So the trees are sucking up the carbon. So it's fair to say that negative emissions technologies suck CO2?
Yes. Yeah. So they do. And the scale we're talking about, we're currently emitting of the order of, say, 40 billion tonnes of CO2 per year globally. If we're going to make an impact on that 40 billion tonnes using negative emissions technologies, we've got to create a new industry that is on that kind of scale. So 10 billion tonnes would be pretty good. But inventing a new industry that can handle 10 billion tonnes of CO2, we're not going to do that in the next 5 years, next 10 years. We'd be lucky if we did that in the next 50 years.
If Exxon put their minds to it, perhaps they could. Then Exxon could suck.
Well, perhaps, but the time scale is so long. So
and the system implications. I mean, people look at these things and you just think, on average, biofuel, biomass has about one quarter the energy density of say, typical fossil fuel. And yet a huge amount of the ships travelling around the world are carrying fossil fuels. So you're going to have to, if you're going to move from fossil fuels to biomass, you're going to have a massive increase in the amount of shipping, all the ports that are going to be available, all of that infrastructure. So when we have these models, you press the button and that infrastructure exists. In reality, of course, that infrastructure takes maybe a decade or two decades just to build.
We can have electric planes, can't we?
Yeah, flying the trees around.
So, I mean, at a company level, you'd look at the energy pyramid if you were trying to deal with issues of energy. And the first thing that you would do is you would consume less because it's the cheapest thing to do.
Yeah.
But what you're saying is that at a global level, because consuming less doesn't fit the economic growth paradigm, we are bypassing that very clear, easy win and moving straight to investment decisions that create new industries that might or might not come about.
Yeah, but I think we have to bear in mind it's not just that they're only relying in these models on negative emissions. There are plenty of other things as well. But actually, it comes back to some ways the same sort of approach. A lot of people are discussing carbon taxes. Sometimes you can have a carbon tax that you can pay, arrange to have the revenue go back to the population more generally, and that's less problematic. There are some benefits of that. But often people just about adding a carbon tax, and if you put the price up, then we consume less. But then you start thinking, well, who's the we there? Again, we're perfectly aware that you and I are not going to consume less if you increase the price of fossil fuels, not with any reasonable margin. We're going to carry on just paying the bill. But the poorer people, the 20% of houses in the UK in fuel poverty, they'll consume slightly less. We're not going to solve climate change. So, in fact, again, is this issue. The wealthy don't want to consume less, but we do think the carbon tax will squeeze the emissions out of the poor people, but without really thinking of the maths through that, because at the end of the day, the poor people aren't hardly emitting.
You are listening to a panel discussion from the NGO Press Center in Katowice, Poland, recorded December 20th by ScientistsWarning.org. This is Radio EcoShock.
So what's an alternative to the carbon tax that would therefore allow, would get over that issue?
Let's be blunt about climate. When we look at climate change, we have a certain carbon budget, total amount of carbon dioxide we can spend over the century.
But that's essentially what was agreed in Paris.
That's effectively what's agreed in Paris, yeah.
And then what we've had recently, this 1.5 report from the IPCC, is giving us ways of achieving this. But if we don't use the negative emissions technologies, what we've got to do is the high emitters have got to emit less, which is this equity problem.
Yeah, we've got to ration it out. What we have is, if we want to meet our Paris commitments, and there are very good reasons to meet those commitments, then we have a carbon ration, a global carbon ration. And you can divide that out between countries, but also I think it's interesting how we divide that out amongst individuals, amongst high emitters. I'm not saying we should only consider it that way, but I think that's important.
So something like tradable energy quotas?
Something like tradable energy, something like that, some sort of mechanism that allows us to have a fair rationing system. So if we accept we must meet the Paris Agreement, if we accept the broad science coming from the IPCC, you are left with this difficult and uncomfortable position that you have to have some form of rationing. And then when you look at the emissions, how they're skewed, and that plays back to the little experiment at the beginning, you can see here the emissions curve. So this is for the different income groups, and you see that the emissions are massively skewed to the top 10, 20, perhaps 30%. So 70% of global emissions, 70% come from about the top 10% of global emitters. And remember, these don't just live in the wealthy parts of the world. There are plenty of people living in China and India and other countries now who are also very, very high emitters.
Apparently, the World Bank only a couple of weeks ago said it was doing away with the term developing countries because precisely of that issue, that wealth is so skewed within countries and across countries.
Yes, yeah. But clearly, the averages are still very different between countries as well. So I think it's worth bearing that in mind.
So what this figure that you mentioned before about it, reducing emissions to that of the average European, and that's somewhere around eight tons of CO2 per person per year?
Yeah, 7 to 8 tons. Okay, territorially, that's just within the boundaries of, say, Europe. If you take out of our imports and exports and everything else, it comes a bit higher, maybe.
But let's just unpick that figure of 8 tons, because 8 tons is about 100 times my body weight. Now, that if I kind of think, I don't emit waste on that scale. If I think of the food waste, you know, it's something like a few hundred kilograms a year at most. And if I think of my excrement, it's a few hundred kilograms a year. I don't emit, personally, waste on anything like the scale we're doing with CO2. And yet, somehow we think it's a real infringement on us as individuals to reduce our CO2 waste from 50 tons a year down to 8 tons a year, because somehow it's our right in some way, because we are economically driven to emit this CO2.
But I think it's interesting, that our whole argument about rights there. What we mean is it's a right for those of us that can afford it to carry on doing it. But already the rights to use energy to improve the quality of life for many poor people is already taken away simply because they can't afford it. So our society is already very happy to have people who cannot afford to enough energy to live good qualities of lives. And that is including in wealthy parts of the world as well, poorer people in those countries, and also elsewhere in the world. So we're happy for them to be constrained, but we're not happy for us, the wealthy ones, at the top of this curve to be constrained.
So what are the things that us wealthy people have to do to take this action?
Well, firstly, it's got to be done virtually immediately. You know, if we're doing now and the next, say, 5 years, that's the really important part. If we're going to come off the curve really fast, then you cannot do that with technologies in the first 5 years. So that's why I often make the point, the first 5 years, the thing you've got to do is drive down changes in behaviour by the very high emitters. And that, there's real scope, when you look at that, for actually driving those emissions down if we're serious about Paris. And when we talk about what does that mean, that means things like we will have to forego a lot of what we might think of as normal things, but most other people see as luxuries. You know, those large cars, the regular flights, the business class flights, you know, having second homes, having very large homes, the very high levels of consumption, the things we've normalised, and we use the language of we're worth it. You know, we think we're worth it, other people aren't.
So I go to the supermarket and it says special this week, 3-for-1 mangoes. And I think, oh, mangoes, they're nice. So how do those mangoes get from wherever they grow to the supermarket in England or in Poland or... And we just don't think about it. Where does the coffee come from? Where do the peanuts come from? It's just taken for granted that we can just get these things.
Yeah.
We have to start thinking about these things very differently.
But also, then when we get them home, you know, we'll take those mangoes, we'll put them in our nice large car, possibly a four-wheel drive, to keep the children protected when we drive them to school. We'll drive them back to our large house, open our double-door refrigerator so we can store our mangoes in there. At every single level, we've normalised very, very high levels of consumption. And so we're going to have to change that very rapidly indeed. So the argument I often make is if we are serious about climate change, which does, of course, require lots of technologies, then we've got to make this transfer of the labour and the resources that at the moment furnish the sort of the relative luxuries of the people at the top of this curve, people like us. The labour and the resources that are furnishing that part of our life are going to be required for making this massive shift to a decarbonised energy infrastructure.
But it's people like us who are making the decisions.
It's the old foxes guarding the chicken coop. I mean, that is the biggest problem, I think. And that's why, to me, having people who are not that wealthy, having their voices heard is really important. And here, probably the most potent voice in the whole of COP24 has been that of a 15-year-old girl, has been Greta, who's raising these very difficult questions to people like us and to her own parents. So there are plenty of people out there who can voice that concern, and we need to make a... they need to grab that power, make that space to be heard.
So do we maybe need to adhere to one of the major rules of good governance, which is removing conflicts of interest?
Well,
from the process.
Yeah. Certainly be very good if we could move conflicts of interest. Well, They're often quite hidden as well.
One thing I don't hear is climate scientists coming out and saying what they really think. Because presumably, surely, the modellers, the people who are doing the underlying climate modelling, are absolutely 100% aware of the things that we're saying. But we don't hear them say it.
Well, I hear them say it quite often.
But in places like
no,
this?
No. If you put a microphone in front of someone or ask them to write something on a piece of paper or type something on their computer to go into the public domain, no, they won't say this. Right. They'll say something nicely fits with the Davos model. But actually away from that, and we'll also, though we don't rely on these things, we do quite conveniently, I think, massage our assumptions to provide nice outputs. But actually privately, you often hear people saying, no, this is, we're just going to hell in a handcart. That's the language I would use. They're using their forms of phraseology. But yeah, that's very commonly the case when you move the microphones away, when you're chatting over a coffee or a beer.
It's interesting. I was at an adaptation meeting a few months ago where the figure for sea level rise that was kind of accepted in the adaptation circles is 0.4 metres by the end of the century. But as soon as you go and have a beer in the pub afterwards, they're privately saying, 1 metre, 1.5 metres, because that's the figure that they've done the models themselves. They know what's coming. But what has to be reported is models that they can say that there's confidence in these models.
Now, that was something that James Hansen and I brought up at the last COP. Jim calls it scientific reticence, and it's a big problem that scientists won't say publicly what they will say privately.
But if you then start saying in the models that at the moment the models don't include feedbacks like Arctic ice, summer ice disappearing, there'll be less albedo, less reflection of sunlight from the Arctic, so the Arctic will warm up, we'll get perhaps release of methane from the permafrost. None of these feedbacks are in the models because, we don't understand them well enough to put them in the models.
Well, some are in the models, and as we get better understanding, they gradually get into the models. But I think it's really worth bearing in mind that lots of great science is going on in these areas, but there's lots of uncertainty. So to me, what we often require is, science is innately conservative, and the actual pure science models I'm very happy with. But what they need to go along with are very clear paragraphs or sets of assumptions. We have not included this for these reasons. These aren't included, and what might happen if these things end up being as bad as we think?
But it doesn't happen like that, because you get these reports, like that IPCC 1.5 report. Where does it mention the permafrost? And it's not as if the people reading it, not as if the journalists reading it, are going to say, by the way, this report doesn't include some important feedback. That never gets set.
No, it doesn't get. And actually, I think there is a role there for journalism, because actually the reports themselves, even if you look at some of the policymakers, in the greyer text rather than the bold text, it does say these things. So I think there's an honesty there, but it's the role in the journalist to pick them out, particularly in the really good journalists who are trying to inform the public, to put them there. But overall, I think the science is doing a good job, but these other caveats are really important and need to be emphasised much more than they are.
And including, there was a Nature article that we brought up the other day as well, including the caveat of the policy environment, the feedback loops of it's relying on a stable policy environment. We have to take a more conservative view of what actually is going to be implemented, and as well as the emissions gap report, which came out the other day. Yeah. So we're talking about Paris here, but when you look at what's actually been committed there in terms of NDCs, it's way off where we need to be.
NDCs, please define your terms.
Sorry, national declared contributions.
Determined contributions.
Determined contributions.
Those are the voluntary targets that nations can then lie about.
It's also worth bearing in mind that we had the Global Carbon Project just report this year, that the emissions in 2018 look they're going to be up something around about 2.7% growth. It was 1.6 last year, 2.7 this year. So we're going completely the wrong direction. So we're not even heading towards the NDCs, these pledges, these promises that are made. So I do think we need to sort of almost stop and reflect that we are 28 years now on since the first report from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. The emissions are probably about 65% higher and are still going up. And we still meet in these events like this, and we still say the same things we've been saying for pretty much 28 years.
And the simple things that we can do are to be done by the richest 10%, because not much point in asking the people that don't consume very much at all to consume less.
Yeah, I mean, that's always my point. This plot is a really good example. It comes from the work originally by Lucas Chancellor and Thomas Piketty in 2015 on carbon inequality, and then the infographic was done later. But basically, if you look at that, you can't squeeze carbon emissions out of people who hardly emit. And that's such a fundamental thing you get when you look at the data. But we're not, even in COP, we're not prepared to accept that.
I actually did my PhD on this very topic back in 2002. And when I spoke to someone from what's then DEFRA about why in the UK we're not focusing, I also studied in South Africa where the inequalities are really stark, why are we not focusing the efforts on the areas where we can make the most difference? It's just logical. And I was told that it's not politically viable.
No.
Well, so we often talk about, people should fly less. And then the retort is, oh, well, flying only represents 2%, let's say, of global CO2 emissions. But isn't it right to say that the type of people who are flying lots are also the same people who've got high consumption lifestyles? So by picking out the people who fly a lot, are we also picking out the people who have other aspects of their lifestyles that are high emission?
Well, I think it's flying is emblematic. Of course, not everyone who flies will be very high emitters. Most of them will be. There'll be other people who occasionally fly for whatever reason who won't be. But it's emblematic of a very high carbon lifestyle. People who are the frequent flyers particularly, you know, academics amongst them. You know, we will live in typically larger houses than the average person. We'll drive a bigger car. We'll drive further. We'll consume more goods. You know, we go to a lot more conferences. We'll probably have more holidays away. We'll have weekend breaks somewhere. So almost every facet of our life is going to be much higher consumption.
So
the flying is, though, important as well. I mean, we have to bear in mind that everyone always says everything's only ever 2%. UK's 2%. California's 2%. Flying's 2%. Shipping's 2%. 50 times 2 is 100. 2% is important. Yeah. And actually, it's a particular industry here where there are no alternatives in the near to medium term, to move away from it being locked into a high-carbon infrastructure, and it's growing very rapidly. But it's not the only issue. There are many other issues to address.
So I think if we want people to know whether they're in the problem zone or not, is it perhaps fair to say that if you fly more than 10 hours a year, is that a reasonable figure? If you're doing 100 hours for flying a year, you're definitely in the problem. 10 hours, is that a good kind
of... Well, I mean, you'd have to do the calculations, but... I mean, my concern there is that, yes, even if you're just doing the 10 hours, there are problems because you're locking in the high-carbon infrastructure. Well, you're locking in the airport.
But what
and the
I'm
aircraft.
Trying to say is, let's think about alcohol consumption. Unless you put a figure on it, then you're going to say, oh, I don't drink too much.
Yeah.
But as soon as you put a figure on it, whichever it is, you know, 5 bottles a night.
Well, yeah.
then, you know, you need some reference point. And I suspect the ordinary person doesn't know that they're in that top 10%.
They may not. Most of us here know we're in that top 10%,
and we still don't.
We have a final quote.
It's a quote that came out of a Twitter discussion with Alex Steffen, who always makes really interesting comments. And he said, and I think it really captures where we are, winning slowly is basically the same thing as losing outright. In the face of both triumphant denialism, and we see that with the US, with Russia, with Qatar, with Saudi last few days,
With Poland.
And predatory delay. But we see that everywhere, whether that's Denmark, France, the UK, or Sweden, the progressive countries, whether it's the people intending us people attending COP. We see the predatory delay everywhere. Anything we can do to avoid making the changes today and passing the buck to the next generation. So we're all party to that. But then he goes on to say, to achieve climate action by doing the same things, the same old ways, means defeat. It guarantees defeat. And we've been doing the same things at COPs and discussing the same issues within our governments for 28 years, and the emissions are 65% higher. At some point, we have to wake up and smell the coffee. You know, we are failing abysmally, and we have to start to rethink this differently.
So if we should be flying less, why are we thinking about building a third runway at Heathrow Airport? Is that we're doing the same thing all the time?
Well, we're all gambling. We were gambling on so many levels. We're gambling on technology in the future. We're gambling on the feedbacks. We're gambling on electric planes and all these other things that are there. So,
now, I'm going to have to end our brilliant discussion here. If you've had any trouble understanding, because our friend Kevin speaks so fast. He's told me you have to listen more quickly in the future. This has been another Scientist's Warning program. I'm your host, Stuart Scott, my co-host, Victoria Hirth. Here's contact address for us if you have any questions or comments for our guests. And we've been coming to you live from the UN Climate Negotiations COP24 in Katowice, Poland. Thank you for joining us.
That was a live panel discussion from the United Nations NGO Press Center, recorded December 10th, 2018, in Katowice, Poland. Find the videos at scientistswarning.tv. This is Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. Next up, Dr. Peter Wadhams, professor of ocean physics and head of the Polar Ocean Physics Group at the University of Cambridge, UK. This interview by Stuart Scott of scientistswarning.org was pre-recorded and presented in Poland on December 7th, 2018. Next up, Dr. Peter Wadhams, professor of ocean physics and head of the Polar Ocean Physics Group at the University of Cambridge, UK. This interview by Stuart Scott of scientistswarning.org was pre-recorded and presented in Poland on December 7th, 2018.
The government can make a commitment saying in 30 years' time we'll have reduced our CO2 emissions by 80%. They can quote any number they like because they have no intention of keeping to it.
I want to thank you for coming to another Scientist's Warning program. I'm your host, Stuart Scott, along with my co-host, Victoria Hirth, and we're coming to you live from COP24 in Katowice, Poland. Victoria is an associate professor of sustainable business from the University of Plymouth in the UK. And I'm the executive director of the ScientistsWarning.org organization and a member of Survival University. Today's virtual guest, Dr. Peter Wadhams. Dr. Wadhams is an expeditionary scientist. He's an expert in Arctic polar ice dynamics. He's an emeritus professor of ocean physics from Cambridge University. And today's program, IPCC Underestimates and Political Cowards. This is Dr. Wadhams. Behind him is a British nuclear submarine. He, for 40 years, went under the polar ice cap to determine the thickness of the ice, because satellite measurements can only determine the extent. And so Professor Wadhams' research was unique in the world because he was able to see the volume decreasing. And that is his book, A Farewell to Ice, a kind of tragic story of the disappearance of the polar ice cap. Now, I want to note to you that just 2 days ago in Nature, a very august journal, this article appeared, Global Warming Will Happen Faster Than We Think. And I want to call your attention to one of the three authors. Dr. Ramanathan is the director of the Scripps Institute of Oceanography in La Jolla, California. And Dr. Wadhams has spent several periods down there. So I believe Dr. Wadhams' fingerprints are on this document as well. These are quotes from the middle of the document, but the latest IPCC special report underplays another alarming fact. Global warming is accelerating. So when I interviewed Dr. Wadhams on the internet a couple of weeks ago, I asked him, what are your thoughts about the recent IPCC 1.5 special report? And here is some of what he said.
It is a genuine attempt to work out what we would have to do in order to keep the temperature rise down to 1.5. And it does raise the alarm because most IPCC reports are quite complacent. This one is saying we have to do something, we have to do it rapidly. So in that sense, it's very positive. But when you look at the detail, it has a tendency to go back to the old complacency, because it says that this can only be achieved by a massive change in our way of life. But then it doesn't actually specify what that massive change must be. It simply specifies continued efforts in the same directions as we're meant to be using under the Paris Agreement for a 2-degree warming. So it's simply saying, let's do a 2-degree warming effort, but work a bit harder. So that doesn't imply massive changes to your way of life. There was a very nice description of the IPCC report by Thelma Krug, who's the vice chairman of IPCC at the recent conference here in Tokyo. And she seemed quite happy about what the report was saying and really didn't seem stress at all what we actually need to do, what hoops we have to jump through if we really are going to reduce our emissions to the point where we can keep the temperature down to 1.5. The idea in the report, in fact, is that total emissions have to be zero by 2050. That means we abolish all fossil fuel use and everything is by renewable energy. But there may be some carryover, some small carryover, just a few renegade countries doing something. And she mentioned the Chinese coal program, which is massive. And you can allow, if you have some kind of overrun because somebody is still emitting CO2, then you will need to do some CO2 removal. So you need to have some air capture, some direct air capture to get rid of those small amounts of CO2 that are still being emitted by recalcitrant emitters, like everybody in the world. And that's the very dubious thing, because what it really means is we'll have to take carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere as the main way of keeping the CO2 levels down. With the removal, the reduction of emissions is just not going to happen. Also, she's very much against the use of geoengineering. And specifically, they say in the report, and she says personally, they don't like geoengineering because we don't know, we don't understand the risks of doing it. So whatever it is, whether it's marine cloud brightening or putting aerosols into the atmosphere, we do it, we don't know what the results will be. They may be disastrous, they may be bad, so let's not try it. So if we're going to have to do something drastic to keep the temperature rise down to 1.5, it should be direct air capture, not geoengineering. And the distinction is very interesting, because what we're doing now to the climate is absolutely disastrous. So to say we shouldn't try geoengineering methods because we don't know whether they'll be good or bad is a little bit daft, because we know that what we're doing now is bad. So anything else we try might well not be as bad.
So I asked Dr. Wadhams, how accurate do you consider the modelling of the IPCC to be? And this is what he responded.
You see the fingerprint of very poor modelling in there. The people who wrote that 1.5 degree report didn't include any ice scientists that I recognise anyway. When they realised they had to actually include what would happen to ice in the report, they go to standard modellers using these already discredited models that predict that ice won't retreat very much right till the end of the century. And that's already been proven wrong by what's actually observed to happen. So they've just parroted that and come up with these things, which are completely wrong and dangerously wrong, because if the ice-free summer starts soon, if it will, then that brings on a whole load of other feedbacks that are going to get worse very rapidly, like a further feedback on sea level rise because Greenland will start melting more rapidly, a further feedback of albedo because the snow lines are going to be melting back faster. And so all the bad feedbacks that you get associated with ice retreat are going to get bad more rapidly. So if you don't say there's going to be an ice retreat, you don't have to think about all those other feedbacks. But in fact, if you do accept there'll be an ice retreat, then you have to say that all these feedbacks might happen as well. regardless of whether we can keep warming to 1.5 degrees, these are things that are going to happen with our present climate.
Now, I want to make an apology. I see at least one member of the IPCC in the audience. I think the title was provocative enough to catch eyes. And I don't mean to be attacking the IPCC. I mean to be holding them to a higher standard than they currently have been exhibiting, because it's a joke in the industry that the reality is always at or above what the IPCC has been predicting. Now, albeit I give them a lot of credit for honestly trying, but I think they've been hobbled by the policymakers they're meant to advise. It's a question of limits that have been put on them in part, but there's also omissions. They are not factoring in the reality on the ground, such as the disappearance of the ice caps. So I went on to discuss with Dr. Wadhams, is it really true that carbon dioxide reduction promises made by governments are inadequate? And how do you reconcile that with reality?
Yes, I mean, it's pretty blatant, but it could have been foreseen, because you know that governments are cowardly and that politicians are cowardly.
That governments are cowardly and that politicians are cowardly. Now, I hope that's not libelous. It's a personal opinion, but they are certainly not stepping up to the plate. Their money interests always dominate over what they're squabbling about in this rule book, what they've been squabbling about for 25 years is who's going to make more money or give away money, or it's always about money. It always goes back to money. The health of the planet, the health of the population of the planet seems to always take a backseat to economic concerns. That's my view of the failure of what's going on out there.
So the government can make a commitment saying in 30 years' time we'll have reduced our CO2 emissions by 80%. They can quote any number they like because they have no intention of keeping to it. And so that's the terrible thing about the Paris Agreement, that all the nations of the world agreed for the first time that they would reduce their CO2 emissions. But they all produce voluntary figures for what that reduction would be. And as soon as the economic situation changes or they can identify some sudden need, they'll say, oh, sorry, we can't keep to that commitment because of X, X and Y. But they'll never come back and say, oh, we're doing better, that we're going to do better than we originally said because we've developed the new techniques for reducing emissions and we're really striding ahead. It's always that they will find ways not to do what they say they're going to do. So that's why I really despair that by 2050 we will have zero emissions. I think by 2050 we'll have emissions that are quite possibly higher than they are today, and that everything that all of the politicians have said about emissions reduction is, as you say, hot air.
Now, I want to use this moment to make an award for climate villains. I'm going to be doing this every day. We have enough bad actors to share the blame or share the spotlight, shall we say. And in this case, I'm going to cite Theresa May as the climate villain of the day. She's unwanted, dread if alive, and she's unwanted for flaunting the UK's carbon reduction commitments and instead expanding fossil fuel infrastructure and fracking commitments while reducing or removing incentives for renewable energy sources. This is despicable. Back to the Nature article, and I want to point out this particular quote. Would you read it for us?
Yeah, certainly. Better assessment can motivate action, but will also be politically controversial. It will highlight gaps between what countries say they will do to control emissions and what needs to be achieved collectively to limit warming.
Now, I find this to be very, very polite talk. Basically, politically controversial. Okay, let's proceed. So if the national commitments are hot air, how can we prevent a catastrophe, is what I asked Dr. Wadhams.
That's why we absolutely have to have air capture, because we can't trust people or politicians to actually make the adjustments to our daily way of life that are needed to reduce our emissions down to zero.
Again, returning to the article.
The excessive reliance on negative emissions technologies that take up CO2 in the IPCC special report shows that it becomes harder to envision realistic policies the closer the world gets to such limits. It's easy to bend models on paper, but much harder to implement real policies that work.
I think the point I want to make here is that the IPCC report has been limited to science, and they've been told, probably instructed, not to offer solutions. Okay, don't advise us, don't offer us policies. But the politicians it's easy to ignore and easy to adjust the models a little bit, but much harder to implement according to what the models are demanding. Okay, so if direct air capture is not likely to happen in time or at the necessary scale, what are the alternatives?
The people who don't believe in direct air capture or would rather we didn't do it, the alternative they always come up with is afforestation. And if magically we could all plant millions of saplings and everywhere in the world, including in deserts and so on, if we reforest the world, then the extra carbon dioxide absorption will be as good as if we did direct air capture. The trouble is the calculations show that the reforestation would have to be about half the land area of the planet, which of course makes it difficult to grow any food. Plus the fact that at the moment we're tearing down forests as fast as we possibly can in the Amazon and the Far East, everywhere, including Germany now. So if we're tearing down forest in order to take account of the needs of 10 billion people, then we're not going to bring carbon dioxide levels down by reforestation, because we're not reforesting. So that's a very weird thing, that this trying to say we don't need to do direct air capture of CO2 because we can do reforestation. And there are well-meaning groups who go around spending money on having little copses of trees that they plant and having children plant trees and so on. It's all well-meaning, but the effects are trivial compared to the stripping away of forests that are being done on an industrial scale. So we can't depend on reforestation. And certainly if the Germans are stripping away their forests in order to burn coal, then one may as well give up in despair.
Yes, the Germans are stripping away or are threatening to strip away the Hambacher Forest very close to Bonn, Germany, for another lignite coal mine, dirtiest coal on the planet. And the Germans have already said earlier this year through their environment minister that they will not meet their goals under the Paris Agreement. So I wanted to raise the question of the lack of scientific integrity. I told Dr. Wadhams, I've heard that scientists with data and conclusions that threaten the mainstream scientific narrative are routinely overlooked or censored. And I asked him to discuss that a bit.
I was invited to China to give a talk to the Chinese Academy of Sciences, and the book of all the presentations left out my chapter, which was about subsea methane. And it turned out that one of the editors was a guy from Harvard who didn't believe that methane can be emitted from the ocean and just said, I'm not having that in my book. And so they left it out without telling me they were leaving it out. So that's the kind of low thing that scientists often sink to and sometimes makes you despair as to the integrity of scientists when we're depending on the integrity of scientists to get the message of climate change across.
Since we do have an influential member of the IPCC here, I'll say please take a climate scientist on board, and Dr. Wadhams, I believe, is the foremost, and it's been commented endlessly on the videos I put out, why is Dr. Wadhams not part of the IPCC?
This is the final part of the Nature document, and it says, for decades, scientists and policymakers have framed the climate policy debate in a simple way. Scientists analyze long-term goals, and policymakers pretend to honor them. Those days are over. Serious climate policy must focus more on the near term and on feasibility. It must consider the full range of options, even though some are uncomfortable and freighted with risk. Policymakers have less time to respond than they thought. And in fact, the whole article is really about mirroring, in a way, what Peter Waddams was saying, that there is an issue with the reality, the realpolitik, of actually implementing these solutions. And when we're looking at what needs to be done, we cannot just pretend the world is somehow going to change and we are going to be able to do things in political realities that don't exist.
The slide will advance too quickly, so I want to read what I had underlined, that nations need to make their forests and farms more resilient to droughts and prepare coasts for inundation. I believe our biggest threat, not ocean rise, our biggest threat is the lack of food. If we have a few more seasons of drought, such as we've seen this year, it will be hard for us to feed the existing population, no less the 8, 9, or 10 billion we're expecting by mid-century. Now, we have just a few seconds, so please make a very quick question.
All right. Thank you very much for the work that you're doing. And I just have a question. Do you think that we can even avert runaway climate change? Is it actually still possible to reach these 1.5 degrees?
That is the, as we used to say in America, the $64,000 question. Of course, now $64,000 is not a lot of money. My personal opinion is no, that we are already in runaway condition, and we have to be scrambling back to safety as quickly as possible through letting scientists test geoengineering, for heaven's sake. Let them determine what's safe, okay, reforesting the planet, but certainly clamping down on the bad actors, and there are plenty of those, getting the fossil fuel industry out of the climate negotiations. Now, we're out of time, so I want to thank you all for coming again. I'm Stuart Scott, Victoria Hirth, my co-host, coming to you live from COP24 in Katowice, Poland, and there is our contact address if anybody would like to get in touch. Thank you for coming.
That was Dr. Peter Waddams, head of the Polar Ocean Physics Group at the University of Cambridge, and Stuart Scott, founder of ScientistsWarning.org. Find links to the corresponding videos in my own weekly show blog, published every Wednesday at ecoshock.org. That's ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
I knew the COP24 climate talks were going nowhere when I heard that America, Russia, and Saudi Arabia blocked a welcome to the latest IPCC 1.5 degree report. The Paris climate talks of 2015 asked for that scientific work, what it would look like, and what we need to do to stay at, 1.5 degrees, which I think is unrealistic now. Every nation approved it last June, but now it's not acceptable to the world's largest fossil fuelers, so no thanks. We don't need the science, and apparently we don't care about a livable future either. The international climate talks have become a dangerous fantasy. We all pretend there is a plan. Our leaders are trying to do something to save us from climate change. But it is a facade, a false front. It's derailed by fossil fuel interests, international banking system, and our own addiction to this wasteful, polluting way of life. America, Russia, Brazil, Saudi Arabia, Australia, Canada, Poland, everyone is backsliding into climate denial. As my old friends in London, David and Evelyn Wasdell of the Apollo Gaia Project write in their 2018 Christmas letter to friends, quote, "As anxiety increases around the world, so the power and intensity of the social defenses against anxiety escalate at every level." The more we hear about California in flames, Venice flooding out, drought driving millions of climate refugees, the more defensive people who burn lots of fossil fuels become. I'm talking about us. We are like heroin addicts, drowning out mom and dad and their talks about recovery and quitting with heavy metal music. Writing about the climate talks in Poland, David Wasdell says, quote, "Policymaking becomes insulated from scientific input and controlled by powerful vested interests in the economic elites, personal, organizational, and international. And perhaps thinking of the carbon tax rioters in Paris, he writes, "All energy and activity that should be mobilized to engage with external reality becomes internalized to deal with rising angst. That is the footprint of collective psychosis whose onset I outlined and predicted some 14 years ago." End quote. Indeed, my show featuring David Wasdell continues to be one of the most downloaded Radio EcoShock programs ever. Tens of thousands of people have listened to it already. It's called Facing the Harsh Realities of Now. You can Google that. It's still a fantastic overview of climate feedbacks that official groups, like the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, continue to overlook. That is why the world will warm much faster than you have been told. Find links to that program and the supporting materials at apollo-gaia.org in my own show blog at ecoshock.org. So, world governments have failed once again to set a course to a safe future. What a surprise. Globally, while the majority of humans are maybe worried, we push forward to using more of Earth's limited resources while dumping plastics into the sea, toxins into our food, and carbon into the sky. As the Swedish schoolgirl Greta Thunberg says frankly, there is little interest yet in talking about global warming, even among the young, much less changing our lives to limit the developing damage. Personally, this tells us that no government will ever act to save us. Perhaps only personal bravery can. You and I know the science. We can see the reality. But it is not pleasant or easy to harp on other people, to tell them their lives are going dangerously wrong. But either we become brave enough to speak up, even to workmates, to family, to strangers. Don't take that useless travel flight. Don't buy another wasteful consumer holiday spending spree. Walk or bike when you can. Tell them and show them with our own actions. Or admit that none of us cares enough to save the current wonders of creation. The revolution, if it comes, will not be at the ballot box or on TV. It will be a mass social change, beginning at first in a few million lives, in the most common choices, as we avoid more greenhouse gases and spoiling this planet home. You and I, that is all we have. Again from last week's program with Greta Thunberg, even if there is no hope, we have to do something. Not having hope is not an excuse for not doing anything. The one thing we need more than hope is action, because once we start to act, hope is everywhere. Thank you, Greta, for those words. I'm Alex Smith. This is Radio EcoShock. Thank you for listening and caring about your world.
And now, before giving you the details, I bring you a warning. Every one of you listening, tell the world. Tell this to everybody wherever they are.